Hello. Today is June 24th, 2020. This is John Richardson. I am speaking with you from Toronto, Canada, and this is one more of my ongoing series of podcasts on all or some things affecting U.S. persons. And today I'm continuing with one of my favorite and most special guests, Virginia Latorre-Jeeker, who is a U.S.-based lawyer in Dubai who works with Americans abroad, green card holders, and all kinds of people who are afflicted with the problem of having to deal with the U.S. tax system. Well, last month, we began a discussion of green card holders, what it means to be a green card holder, how they're taxed, etc. And at the end of that conversation, we were beginning to raise the question of what happens when a long-term resident of the United States decides they no longer want that green card and may, in fact, have to pay an exit tax. And today, that's the topic of our discussion. Welcome, Virginia. Thank you for participating.
Hi, John. Always a pleasure to speak on one of your podcasts.
Well, this one is going to be a particular amount of fun because, the topic is actually interesting. I think that this is going to be of tremendous value for people who haven't heard this. And frankly, I think after having heard this, a lot of people are going to be saying, oh, my God, you can't even make this stuff up. It's so horrible. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, John. In fact, I'm working with a client now that is saying that those exact words.
Yeah, that's it. You can't make this stuff. Okay, so just to set the stage for our discussion. In the beginning, we have an individual who moves to the United States permanently as a permanent resident visa, which is known as a green card, lives his life. And then at some point, that person may decide that, well, he no longer wants that green card and wants to move from the United States. And that person calls you on the phone and says, Virginia, what is it I have to know? How would you begin your discussion?
Okay. Well, the first thing I ask this person is when he got his green card. And we have to then figure out, is he someone who's considered a long-term resident for U.S. tax purposes? And generally, this is someone who has had the card for 8 years out of the past 15 tax years. People have to be very careful when they do the counting. So I'll give you an example, John. Let's say the person got the green card in December of 2013. That year, 2013, will count as a full year when you're counting those 8 years, even though he's only had the green card for 30 days or something in the year 2013. So it's very easy to reach this eight-year number because the year you get it, even if that is a short, very short time period left in the year, and the year you are giving it up, will each count as separate full years in the counting of the 8 years. So it's quite often a surprise to people that they meet that eight-year mark, so quickly.
So really, they have to watch out. Like 6 full years and 2 one-day periods, I guess, couldn't they?
Absolutely. They could.
Oh, my God. That's terrible. So if they meet the test.
There's no way out of it either. There's no, for example, we do have certain rules that say, oh, if you've spent too many days in the U.S. and you want to avoid the substantial presence test, you can do this. There's no escape hatch for this problem. So people have to be very, very aware of that when they're getting the green card. People become disillusioned after living in the state sometimes, and they say, well, I want to get out. And, they better figure that out before they hit the eight-year mark.
So it's simply the status, the legal right to live permanently in the United States, which is what triggers it.
Correct.
And you could theoretically have an actual document green card that has expired. And that would have no bearing on it, would it?
Absolutely no bearing.
Okay, so I just want to reinforce this point again.
The separation.
Yeah, I want to reinforce the point again for listeners that The green card itself is not the immigrant visa. It's simply evidence of it. So the question is, as a matter of law, does somebody have the right to reside permanently in the United States? So if you meet the 8 out of 15 year, okay, if you don't meet the 8 out of 15 year test, then can the exit tax rules apply to you?
No.
Right, because you're not a long-term resident at all. So given that you're a long-term resident, and we want to be able to exit the United States without problems, what are the ways that a green card holder or a permanent resident could actually sever tax residency with the United States?
So you're talking about someone that now wants to give up the green card. How does he go about doing that?
That's right. I have had enough. I'm going home. Yep.
Going home. Okay. Well, you have to properly relinquish your green card under the tax rules in order to sever your relationship with Uncle Sam. And again, this is very different from a tax perspective than it is from the immigration side. So the first thing you need to do is fill out this form for immigration purposes. It is called I-407, which indicates your intention to give up the green card. So that's a very simple form to fill out. Now, when you are giving up the card, what I always have my clients do is go to the consulate or the embassy in whichever country they are in, the U.S. consulate or U.S. embassy, and actually hand in the form with the green card. And sometimes they have another document that allows them, it's called the White Book, I think, allows them to live overseas for a portion of time and not have this impact their U.S. immigration status as a permanent resident. So if they have that, then they also should be bringing that with them. So when they go to the consulate or the embassy, they should meet the consular officer, given the I-407. Everything will be stamped and approved. And they must be very careful to make sure they are given a copy of the I-407, indicating that they have submitted their documents and given it up. So that piece of paper is very important to them. That is proof that they have given it up. Now, from a tax perspective, what must they do? If they are one of these long-term residents, they have to file with the IRS a special tax return the calendar year after the year they have given up the green card. So if they've given up the green card in 2020 this year, the Internal Revenue Service information must be filed in 2021. That is their final tax return. It is something called a dual status return, because this individual, for part of the year, he was a U.S. person, he was a U.S. taxpayer. And after he gave up his green card for the balance of the year, he is a non-resident alien. So he has to file what's called the dual status return to reflect this double status that he has.
Okay. And now, as I understand the dual status return, so your U.S. tax status would depend on your status on December 31st of the year. So the main return then would be a 1040 NR because he ceased to be a resident. And then I understand that there's a statement, if you will, that would be a 1040 reporting worldwide income up to the date that a green card was handed in, correct?
That's basically correct, John, but I have one caveat there. And a lot of people are not aware of this, including tax professionals, unfortunately. The U.S. has a default rule which says your residency termination date is considered to be December 31 of the year that you've given up the green card. So if you've given up your green card, let's pretend you gave it up in August, you want your U.S. tax liability to on your worldwide income to end on that date. So from that, the next day going forward, you don't want to be taxed as a U.S. person taxable on your worldwide income. So if you gave up the green card on August 10th of 2020, as of August 11th, you don't want to have any U.S. tax on your worldwide income. When you file that form, the dual status tax return that we spoke about, if your default is considered to be your residency termination date default is considered to be the end of the year, December 31, unless you do something. What must you do? You must file a special written statement and have your tax residency termination date be August 11th. You say, I have a closer connection to whatever foreign country than to the United States for the balance of the year. You submit, you know, a lot of information on that statement saying why you have a closer connection to that foreign country than to the United States. And then your residency termination date should be August 11th in our example. I see that that statement is often just omitted. People don't do it.
Often.
I've spoken to a number of professionals that just aren't aware. You know, they think, oh, well, from August 11th onwards, he's an NRA, non-resident alien, and we file accordingly. But that's not what the law says. So you have to be very careful with that one and make sure that you're part of your package with that dual status tax return is containing a statement proving that you do have a closer connection to another country than to the United States for the balance of your year.
Very, very interesting. Okay, so
yeah,
when you file the dual status return, and by regulation it does include the statement that's the 1040, mm-hmm. if there were an exit tax amount owing, that would appear on the 1040 portion on the statement, correct?
That's correct. We should mention here, John, that part of your dual status return must include a form 8854. This is for long-term residents. Again, someone that's held the card for the 8 tax years out of the past 15. So he's got to file the dual status return in order to get his termination date, residency termination date, to be the day after he gave up the green card. He's got to have that closer connection statement as part of his package. And he must also include this form 8854, which we are going to, I'm sure, dissect.
Okay, now, in a general sense, the purpose of the form 8854 is to give the IRS information that's required to determine whether an exit tax under Section 877A would be payable. Have I got that right?
Basically, yes. It is the Form 8854 is giving the IRS information for them to determine if this individual is a so-called covered expatriate. If he is a covered expatriate, bad things are going to happen to him from a tax perspective. And one of these bad things is the exit tax that you've just mentioned. But there's other bad things. So
could I ask you to tell us what would make somebody a covered expatriate? We know that's bad. We know it must be avoided if possible. What is it that we're avoiding? What would make a person a covered expatriate?
Okay. So there are three tests that apply. If you meet any one of these three tests, you will be a covered expatriate. So the first test is what we call the average income tax test. And what you do is you look at the person's average annual net income tax that he's paid for the 5-year period prior to the termination of his residency. So essentially what you do is you get his tax returns. You say, if the guy is expatriating in 2020, I've got to look at the 5 tax years prior. So that would be 19, 18, 2017, 2016, 2015. You look at those 5 years. You say, how much income tax has he paid in each year? You add all the numbers up of the tax that he's paid, and you divide by 5. That gives you the average of the 5 years. So you remember, this is not the income the man or woman has earned. This is the income tax that they have paid. So when you get that average number for the 5-year period, if it exceeds a certain dollar amount that is adjusted for inflation under the statute, then you will be a covered expatriate. For 2020, The number is $171,000. So the average tax paid by the person in the past 5 years has to be $171,000 or more. So most people I'm dealing with do not have that kind of a tax liability. That's usually not the test that I see being triggered, but that is one test.
But on that test, interesting, before we move on to the second test, just an observation and possible question or confirmation. People who live in high tax countries, say Canada, the UK, would be able to use non-US taxes as tax credits to offset US tax liability. But people who live in countries that don't have income tax would be more likely to have higher U.S. tax liability. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so average tax liability, that's the first test. Second test.
Second test, and this one is the one I see being triggered most often, is the person has a net worth of $2 million or more on the date of the termination of residency. And it's quite easy nowadays. $2 million net worth, Joan, is easy to meet these days.
It is. It certainly is. And I understand that's not indexed to inflation.
Correct. It's not indexed for inflation. And this law came in 2008. I think that $2 million
was 2008. Think also of the inflation because of this COVID-19 thing with governments pumping all this money into the system, right?
Yes, absolutely.
This would be a great blog post. How COVID-19 will create many more covered expatriates. It's true.
My.
It's absolutely true.
It is. It is.
Okay. And the third test?
So we've got $2 million net worth. And just to make that clear what that means, when we say net worth, that's the fair market value of all of your assets minus your liabilities. So if you have a mortgage on your house, for example, you take away that mortgage amount to reach your net worth.
And to
third
be
clear,
things like pension plans are considered assets for the determination of the net worth, correct?
Sadly, yes, John, they are.
What about non-grantor trust interests?
Those are a little more difficult. But as a general matter, you have to look at the trust agreement very carefully and see, is there any argument I can make that this beneficiary of the trust, who is one of, let's say, five beneficiaries, that he does not have, you know, an interest that we can value and put a value on. So, for example, if it was a discretionary trust and the trustee had complete discretion to give to five beneficiaries, or two out of five, or none out of five, he had complete discretion to do what he wanted, and the historical distributions showed that this individual who's giving up his green card never received anything, you might possibly have an argument that he doesn't really have an interest in the trust that you can put a value on. But this is a very complex area. It is something where you really need professional guidance. So the area of trust is difficult. Sorry,
okay.
My thing keeps going off here.
All right. And we'll talk about how different kinds of assets are taxed differently in a few minutes. But the third possible way to become a covered expatriate would be what?
I'm sorry, John, can you repeat that?
The final way to become a covered expatriate would be what? So we've talked about tax liability, we've talked about net worth.
This is another tricky one for most people where we see issues arise. It's a situation where the individual cannot certify on the form 8854 that he or she has complied with all of his U.S. federal tax obligations for the 5 years preceding the termination of residency. So if you, for example, have someone who has not been filing their tax returns and paying tax, or the most common situation we see is the tax returns have been prepared and submitted and tax has been paid, but the returns are not fully accurate. So sadly, when you have individuals that are non-US people, I'm talking foreign nationals, they can have a green card. Quite often what happens is there are assets overseas, perhaps in their home country or other non-US jurisdictions. And these assets have not been properly reported on the US tax return. So as you know, John, we have many information reports that need to go to the Internal Revenue Service detailing certain information about any foreign financial assets the individual may have, if he has interests in foreign corporations, foreign partnerships, and so forth. Quite often we see that these have not been properly reported. As well, we see this with foreign pension plans. The reason they're not properly reported, there are various reasons, but the biggest problem we see, or I see, is that the tax return preparer who was used to prepare the individual's returns might be based in the United States because the person's a green card holder. He's going to go to Joe Blow down the road, who is, you know, a U.S.-based tax return preparer. They often do not have the expertise and the familiarity with these non-U.S. assets and don't know how to report them. They may not be asking the client the correct questions. They may not be asking them. They may not have a tax organizer that's geared toward finding out about non-U.S. assets. So quite often the problem is the tax returns have been prepared, but they have not been properly prepared, and they need to be corrected. And quite often tax will need to be paid. There may be penalties involved for improper reporting, and the list goes on, but that's a common problem I see, is that the person's tried their best to comply with the tax rules, but unfortunately it hasn't happened. And they cannot certify on that form 8854 that they've been fully tax compliant when they have this kind of problem.
Okay, so those are the three ways to recap: paying too much tax, having too much in the way of assets, or not being a good tax filer. These are the ways that one can be a covered expatriate. Let me now ask you, assuming somebody is a covered expatriate, what are the implications of that, starting off with the possible exit taxes payable?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, if any one of the three tests are triggered that we've just gone through, and the individual is a covered expat, the first thing that can happen to him is he's going to be subject to the exit tax. This is also called the mark-to-market regime. And under these rules, all of the property that the covered expatriate owns in the world, so all of his worldwide assets, it's treated as if each of those assets was sold for the fair market value at the time of the expatriation. And again, this is all a pretend sale. There hasn't been an actual sale. So you really don't have cash in your hands with regard to this pretend sale. So it's a phantom gain that is taken into account for the tax year of this pretend sale. And you're subject to usually capital gains tax rates on the sale of those assets. So that's the exit tax. You have to pay a price to get out of America. In addition to
the land of the free, you have to pay a price to leave.
You bet. And a hefty price as well. In addition to that, I point this out because people say, oh, capital gains tax, okay, it's maximum 20% rate. But you have to remember that when you do the calculation, you are going to as well be subject to what's called this 3.8% net investment income tax. Usually that will also apply to people. It depends on modified adjusted gross income thresholds being met. But in addition to the general capital gains rate, you may have this 3.8% special net investment income tax on top of it. So that's a problem. Now, there is an exclusion amount of capital gain. I can't remember what that number is for 2020. It's adjusted for inflation. I think it's about $700,000 US dollars.
It's around 700,000, but it varies from year to year.
Right. So you get an exclusion for, let's say, $700,000 of gain, but the way that exclusion is computed is according to a certain complicated formula. So you don't say, oh, I've only had $700,000 of pretend gain, therefore I don't owe any tax. It doesn't work like that. So I would say you need the tax advisor and the accountant to really assist you to see how much exit tax you do in fact owe when you take into account.
So the principle is that there's a certain amount of capital gain that you're allowed to have before an exit tax is payable on the property, on the deemed disposal of the property. Is that correct?
Yes, correct, Stone.
Okay. All right, so that's okay. Property. What are the other things that are subject to taxation on the exit tax, under the exit tax rules?
Well, we have certain special rules for deferred compensation and pension plans.
What about those?
Some of these, right. Well, some of them, we have two basic categories of pension plans and deferred comp plans. Some are called eligible and some are ineligible. If you have an eligible one, basically this is a U.S. plan, so you can think of your 401k or your IRA or your general U.S.-based pension plan. That will be taxed when you get the distributions from the plan, and you will be taxed at a 30% rate on the distribution. So if you got $100 distribution,
that's on the ones that are clear that have the status of being a deferred compensation plan as opposed to specified tax deferred account, right?
Yes, maybe you want to explain that difference, John. You might be better at that than I.
Yeah, okay. I don't know that I'm better, but what I think needs to be understood here is that when we get out of the area of the property, then we get into the area of deferred compensation plans as a category and what are called specified tax deferred accounts as a category. If you're a covered expatriate, there are special rules that apply to the specified, to the deferred compensation plans. And now this would be a basic company pension plan or something like that. And if it's a U.S.-based one, it's an eligible, which means basically you get to keep the pension and you pay tax on the distributions as they're made at a rate of
30%. And that 30% rate will apply even if you're in a treaty country. That would entitle you to a lower rate, let's say 15% rate. You don't get the benefits of the treaty. You still have to pay tax at the 30% rate.
Exactly. It's really, in effect, a tax treaty override. Now, for the ones eligible, or I guess they use the word ineligible, in simple terms, these are non-U.S. pension plans. So let's compare, for example, a professor at the University of California. Okay. And in his case, if he expatriates, he's a covered expatriate, that would, in all likelihood, be an eligible deferred compensation plan. So he gets to keep his pension. But let's imagine we have an American citizen living outside the United States, say a professor at the University of Toronto, Canada. If he renounces, his pension plan, because it's not a U.S. pension plan, is ineligible. And therefore, are you ready for this? The person with the non-U.S. pension plan is required to put the full value of the pension plan on his income, his final year return. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're going to cough and skate at the highest marginal tax rate, 37% of the value of the pension, because it's a Canadian one and not a U.S. one. It's this stuff is it, you just can't believe how punitive this stuff is. It is so indescribably unjust. I mean, can you imagine rules that tax assets accumulated when a U.S. citizen was living outside the United States more punitively than assets accumulated while the person was in the United States? I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. It's so unjust.
It's a very difficult dilemma to be faced with. That is why, John, when someone is giving up the green card who's met the, you know, the 8-year mark, or giving up his citizenship because the rules are the same, they absolutely have to find the best tax advisor possible to help them avoid this covered expatriate status. There is planning that one can do. There are ways to try and get around this. So, you know, you really need the best advice, because once you're a covered expatriate, you are hit, and you are hit hard, and there's no mercy. So you've given us a really good example, but I think we can hit home even more with
this. It could get worse than that.
Yes, John, I believe.
Oh my God! I am sitting down. Go ahead. Back to you, Virginia.
Right. Well, you know, sadly, the tax burdens don't stop. Don't stop there at the exit tax. We have very harsh rules that apply to any U.S. recipients. So the person's got to be a U.S. person, recipient of any gift or bequest at any time in the future from the covered expatriate. So the U.S. recipient will be punished. Not the covered expatriate now. The covered expatriate, we're done punishing him. So we are going to go after his children, his spouse, whoever is a U.S. person that receives at any time in the future a gift or bequest from this covered expatriate.
Is that of any amount at all? I mean, say when you expatriate, you're worth $5 million, and when you die and you leave somebody your estate in a will, you're worth $100 million. Is it the $5 million or the $100 million that's subject to this punitive tax?
Sadly, it's the $100 million, John.
You must be kidding me. Are you sure?
No, I'm positive.
Unbelievable. I mean, who can make these rules? I mean, this is, if you look in the dictionary, injustice, does it say U.S. tax policy?
it's bad. And what I find even worse is that when people are going for their green card or obtaining their citizenship, they're not told about any of this stuff. So, you know, I think the assumption is the U.S. is so fantastic. These people should be so happy we're giving them a green card, or so happy they're getting citizenship, that they will never want to leave. Well, that's not what we're seeing in the real world. So, you know, people have to understand that taking a green card is a very serious business. And, you know, I can't tell you, John, how many clients have come to me with green cards that they have actually never really lived in the United States. Let's not get into the immigration side of that, but from a tax perspective, those people are in trouble. They are treated no differently than the guy who used his green card and lived in the United States. So, you know, I've had people that have had green cards for 20 some odd years. They've never really exercised the rights to live in America. They've lived their life abroad. They've had their foreign businesses and so forth. And when they hear these rules, they cannot believe that this is true.
It is interesting.
So let's talk about it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let's just tell them about what's going to, the punishment for the U.S. recipient of the gift or bequest. What we told them, they're being punished, but we didn't tell them how.
Okay.
So the U.S. recipient of the gift or bequest, again, at any time in the future from the covered expatriate, He's going to have to pay a special transfer tax when he receives that gift or that inheritance. And currently, the rate would be a 40% rate on the value of the gift or the bequest. So let's just pretend that covered expatriate father passes away, his son is a U.S. citizen or a U.S. long-term, U.S. green card holder, and he gets an inheritance of, let's say, $1 million from the father. He's going to have to pay $400,000 of that over to the IRS under this rule. Yeah.
Yeah. So not only, I mean, to put this in perspective, okay, not only is it minimally, not only is it triple taxation to start off with, and by that I mean the money was taxed, the assets were bought after tax. They're taxing the covered expatriate on deemed disposition when the assets are you know, at the point of expatriation. And now they're taxing what's left if you try to give it back to a U.S. person. So this is minimally triple taxation. Have I got that right?
Yes, John, you do. So people that give up the green card or give up their citizenship, my advice to them is always, you know, if we can't get you out from being a covered expatriate, then you've got to take your whole family with you.
Exactly. But, you know, Virginia, I call it the family renunciation or, you know, the family expatriation, depending on whether they're citizens or green card holders. But, you know, it's a great family bonding exercise. You know, some families once a year, you know, to just be together. But just think, now we have families getting together to expatriate. It's, I mean, do you think that, you know, I mean, it really, by the way, for listeners, it really is this bad. And I'm sure, and in certain circumstances, you know, it even seems that it can be aggravated. But I'm wondering, Virginia, as, I mean, as an observer, you know, fantastic commentator and writer, and observer of these issues for so many years. I mean, I think you've been doing this for over 30 years, 35 years or something at this point in your life. Do you?
Yes.
Do you think this was deliberate, or do you think that a certain amount of this is unintended consequences that they don't care about?
I think this way. I think it's a combination of the two. I believe that there is a certain amount of disdain for people that give up their citizenship or give up the long-term green card. So they are not viewed in a nice light. So the law will not be at all generous or favorable to them. And because they're leaving, why would a congressman or, you know, any representative care about them? There's no vote left from these people. So if we can earn tax dollars off of their hide, let's do it. And we can have some other favorable tax position provision in the code to help people that will vote for me tomorrow.
Well, on that point,
so there's that. And then I
on
think
that point, it's interesting that the 877A rules, I mean, this took effect in June of 2008, it actually came in as a revenue offset provision to another law, meaning that, you know, it was sort of slipped in, not a lot of attention given to it, but it was designed to offset the cost of some tax break for somebody else, right? And this is the danger of this stuff. So let me ask you a question, Virginia. If somebody came up to you and said, Virginia, something has happened in my life, and I don't know whether this is good news or bad news, but I'm hoping you can tell me, I've just been given a green card.
Well, I think, John, I would be telling them about all of these rules we've discussed and tell them to closely monitor their years, their time, and as they get close to the mark, to make a decision. Because once they overstep the mark, you know, I'm assuming that they will be having a net worth of $2 million. Of course, if none of these issues are going to be relevant, then the person can hold on to the green card and maybe he's very happy he has it. But the people you and I are dealing with need to be thinking about whether they really want to stay in the United States and become citizens going down the road.
You know, the EB-5 visa program has been so successful in the United States. I think the vast majority of the people who have the money to make that investment, which I believe is somewhere between 500,000 and a million, I would have to think that overwhelmingly they're going to meet the net worth test if they try to leave.
Yes. Yes.
So, anyway, this stuff, many years ago, when I first started learning this stuff, I started with the assumption, boy, this is really bad, but there must be something I don't understand. Surely it can't be as bad as this. And years later, I can say with confidence, not only is it as bad as I thought it was, but it's far worse. Is that also your experience?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And as the years have gone on with my practice, John, I've just seen so many people caught up in situations that are simply frightening. I mean, I'll give you as a very brief example, the case I'm working on now, a long-term resident. He just missed getting out, okay? He didn't really want to keep the green card. He told his employer, who had gotten him the green card, listen, you know, I don't think I ever want to work in the States again, because he had worked in the U.S. for this company. He's a U.K. national. I don't think I want to work in the States again. I'd like to get rid of the green card. And they said, you know what? It's no big deal to get rid of it. Hold on to it, because maybe you're going to change your mind, and maybe we're going to have a new opening, and that might interest you. So it was like, okay, well, what happens if I keep holding on to it? And they're like, nothing. When you want to give it up, you fill out a form and you turn it in. So he thought that was the end of that. And sadly, of course, that wasn't the end of that, because now he's right over the 8 years and he's got a big problem. He's got UK pensions. If you look carefully at the UK-US tax treaty and their rules about pensions to see if we can help him with the pensions, sadly, the rules don't apply because he's not treated as a resident for treaty purposes, because he's been living overseas and there's a treaty in place with the UK and the UAE, and there's all sorts of rules that apply when that happens and make you not eligible for for the treaty benefits that might otherwise have possibly assisted him. To make matters worse, he used one of the big accounting firms to prepare the returns. The pensions were never mentioned, never on the returns at all. No Form 8938 was ever filed. So we have a lot of fixing up to do. And sadly, this person cannot fit into the streamlined foreign offshore procedure, which is no penalty imposed for non-willful tax mistakes, because he spent too much time in the United States because of his work. And so he's stuck with, oh my goodness, I have to file streamlined domestic offshore procedure, which entails a 5% penalty, which, by the way, will include the value of the pensions. So it's a nightmare. And he really can't believe that this is happening. Had no clue any of this was going to happen to him. So sadly, people don't understand the repercussions when they get this green card. They have to be made aware, and they're just not. I don't know what the answer to that is. One would think an HR department in a big company would have some information on this, but they're not. They're not with it.
At its core, the problem is the lack of appreciation that different rules apply for tax residency than apply for immigration purposes.
That's yes, correct.
And yeah, so people are thinking in terms of immigration status and that sort of stuff, and they don't think in terms of the, you know, what this means in terms of U.S. tax residency, which is just, you know, this stuff is horrific. It is horrific. Mm-hmm. It destroys lives. It destroys families. And, you know, I mean, if you want to stay in the United States the rest of your life, I think it can be a good place to live. But if you want global mobility, I think the United States is the last country you want any association with. Would you agree?
I think it's a really tough one, John. I can't say in comparison to other countries, but the one thing that people don't appreciate is the U.S. taxes one on the basis of their worldwide income. So it doesn't matter where you reside, you will be responsible for your U.S. taxes. So, you know, you can be a green card holder and living abroad, and you are still going to be responsible for everything earned overseas, your foreign businesses, whatever it is, information reporting. And, you know, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. So unless there's a very good reason for a person to become a green card holder or to keep that green card, I think they seriously need to look at it very carefully with a tax professional and understand the full repercussions. And I am sure, guaranteed, the majority of them would not get the green card.
Oh, I think that's right. Well, there are plenty of visa options that that don't involve the green card. And I think that's what they need to concentrate on. Because it's worth noting that those who are U.S. tax residents, because they meet the substantial presence test, are not subject to the exit tax rules. It's only those who, you know, who are either citizens or need the green card.
That's right. Well, John, I think we've covered all.
Yeah, this has been fantastic, and I want to thank you very much for bringing me through this today. I still feel that I can have a good day after having heard this. So you did it very nicely, very gently, very accurately. But yeah, this is a big problem. So thank you very much, and I look forward.
Yes, John, and I mentioned as well that.
Before I let you go, I'd like you to take a second, okay, to get into the podcast, your coordinates. How would people get a hold of you?
Oh, okay. I think for those who have an interest in the green card issues that we've spoken about, they should visit my U.S. tax blog. I have a whole category for green card holders. And there are many other categories, I'm sure, in the blog that will be of interest to these people. So they can find my blog at www.us-tax.org. Very simple. And if they go to the page about Virginia, they can find all of my coordinates by email and so forth if they need to reach out to me.
That's great. And final question, what's happening with the COVID-19 situation in Dubai? Still in lockdown?
No, we're out of lockdown, fortunately. Things have been opening up slowly, but we still have significant restrictions in place, social distancing, masks, going out. I think they just lifted the age restrictions. We had age restrictions under the age of 12, over the age of 60. You could not go into any malls. You couldn't go into grocery stores. Those have been lifted now, but I just noticed today, the police announced that pubs and bars cannot serve alcohol. That was just announced today, until further notice. So I believe the reason for this is that they're seeing too many people congregating at pubs and bars. And of course, if they can't get alcohol, they won't be going there, right? But right. Alcohol can be served like at a restaurant if you're having a meal. So it's not an issue of the alcohol per se, it's the groups congregating. So right. I don't know if that means numbers are going up and they're saying we've got to eliminate some hot spots, or they're just taking extra precautions. I must say Dubai has done an amazing job with this COVID-19. I've been so impressed. And we still have the disinfection programs going on. We have a curfew post 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. They have disinfection programs going on throughout the city. So you can't be out during those hours. It's been very, very impressive what they've done.
Well, that is good to hear. All right. Well, I look forward to our next chat about this and related topics. And I thank you again for joining me today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, as always. I look forward to the next one.
Great.